dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pass the Mic, Dynamic Voices for a Diverse Church, powered by The Witness, a Black Christian collective. I'm your host, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter at Burns23. Follow at your own risk. And joining me today, I have a very special conversation. I'm really excited about this. It's not going to be Jamar Tisby, no man, the myth, the legend today, but we have a special guest, my good friend, Dante Stewart. Long overdue that Dante is on the podcast, and many of you have followed him on Twitter for a long time. Dante is a prescient voice, a voice for this time, a young Black man who is doing the work. We like to call him Young Baldwin because he's a speaker and a writer, and he's extremely incisive. And his works have been featured, of course, here at The Witness, a Black Christian collective. Also Christianity Today, Fathom Magazine, Faithfully Magazine, Sojourners, and so many others. Dante is a writer, a speaker, and a seminarian as well. Also a Clemson grad, but we're not going to hold that against him. But Dante is really just a passionate voice for justice, a passionate voice for Black identity. And I learned so much in our conversation, hearing him process these things as a young Black man in America, in the Christian space. We talk a lot about tokenism. We talk about what does the church need to do in this season? What do we need to reimagine versus re-education? I thought that was a really interesting part of our discussion. Dante is going to be talking to us today about the idea of Black rage and Black anger and how it's holy and righteous. And so I hope that you feel seen in this conversation. I hope that Black Christians feel as though this conversation speaks directly to you and your lived experience in the wake of murders like Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and yes, George Floyd. We hope that you feel seen, loved, and valued through this conversation with my good friend, Dante Stewart, right here on Pass the Mic. Dante Stewart, thank you for joining us, brother.
Hey, let's go.
Long overdue, I know, right?
Yeah, bro. I've been wondering, man, when y'all was gonna give me a call, bro. I was telling my wife, I was like, man, they ain't called me yet, man. I need to start hitting somebody else. I'm like, I'm doing all this writing. I'm like, man, what?
You know what? You done written about a dozen articles for us, man, and about three dozen for everybody else, man. Yeah. So
I'm just joking, though. I'm totally joking.
No, we need some levity right now. If anything, we need some levity, man. Yeah, and, you know, sure. Normally the common interaction that people ask is, you know, how are you doing? People ask that. You know, it seems like a really vapid question right now. But, you know, the question I want to ask you isn't how you're doing, but I really want to ask you from your perspective, how do you think we're doing as a Black Christian community? Mm-hmm. You know, how are we doing? How are we responding to events? I mean, you have Ahmaud Arbery, of course, and then George Floyd, and we'll get into some of your writings on both of them. Mm-hmm. But how are we doing as a community? Because I think that's probably the more important question than us as individuals.
Yeah, for sure. A great question. You know, I think it's kind of contextualized to which community we found ourselves in as Black people. So I think in some sense, you know, I can in some sense start where I'm at. So I'm situated within the Progressive National Baptist Convention. So I'm situated deeply kind of in the Black church community, Black life, whatnot. And one of the things, you know, that we collectively are wrestling with is, you know, how do we, you know, navigate this moment of being, you know, Black and angry, Black and tired, or whatnot, and really trying to figure out a way, you know, how to, in some sense, have some type of hope to keep going in this moment, and not even necessarily, you know, that hope with things. That hope that things will get better, as much as, you know, a hope, you know, that would allow us to formulate a certain type of response to everything that's going on. So me and my pastor, we're doing a lot of conversing. We actually got on live the other night and we talked about Black rage and white silence. And so we navigated, you know, what does it mean to be Black and furious right now inside of a context where, you know, many of our white counterparts are silent right now. They're wanting to, you know, invite us into like spaces to kind of show, you know, hey, we're about the work, or in some sense, they're hitting us up privately. But they're not incurring any type of risk. And so, you know, we are the only ones who are really having to bear the burden of what it means for Black life to not matter in this society. So, you know, we got on a live for like 2 hours, bro. And, I mean, we was like really venting. It wasn't nothing like planned or anything. It was like a vent, where we're so mad and we're trying to figure out, you know, how to respond to this situation in ways that we can without also, you know, trying to judge other Black folk. Because, you know, that's what's happening right now in this moment is, you know, it's very easy, particularly as Black people, to police the responses of Black grief when Black grief meets Black trauma, and not even simply Black trauma, but when Black grief and trauma meets white rage. And so it's not simply, you know, learning how to navigate Black rage and its response in our world, but also trying to navigate how to survive white rage in the midst of white silence. And so on the one hand, we're navigating that world or whatnot in our context. But if you are Black and in a white space, you're just kind of Black and confused right now.
Right. Of course.
You're Black and confused. And I think, you know, I want to honor that because I was in that space. Many of us have been in that space, that like I have my friends who are in white evangelical spaces right now, you know, asking me, you know, hey, how do you navigate this? How do you do that? And so I think in that space, they're going through those stages of grief. So I don't know if many of them have hit that Black rage yet. But they are going through Black grief right now. And I think in a book, it was The End of White Christian America, Robert P. Jones, at the end of the book, he kind of gave a eulogy for white Christian America. And in his eulogy, he became, in some sense, a therapist for white evangelical Christians, Protestants and Catholics, or like white mainline, whatever. And so he says, you know, white Christians, white people, you know, are going through these stages of grief, of denial, of depression, of anger, of bargaining and acceptance. And I would say Black Christians in white spaces right now are also kind of dealing with that. Some of them are in denial. Some of them are depressed. Some of them are angry and trying to figure out a way out. And some of them are bargaining with white people to, in some sense, to finally see them as human or whatnot. And in some sense, like, that space can be a space of safety psychologically for them, simply to feel like a person, because this world has so beat out of them the profound reality of Black love and Black dignity in a white world. And so some of them are bargaining, and some of them have accepted and just, you know, said, hey, this is my space or whatnot. And so, you know, as Black Christians, that's kind of how we're responding. I think, you know, it gets, in some sense, even one person to try and kind of respond, you know, how people are, Black people in general are responding to this. But also, you know, I think one of the main responses of the collective Black community, whether we're Christian, whether we're Muslim, whether we're religious or not, wherever we are or whatnot, the Black community in general, we, like Fannie Lou Hamer right now, we are sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yes, 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 yes.
We are tired of, you know, this country showing in very public and violent ways that Black lives do not matter. You know, every single year, there is something that happens that forces in our face that Black lives don't matter, and that your response to this needs to be apathy.
And you need
to stay in your place. And I think, you know, as collective people, we're Black and tired right now.
Man, that's so helpful. Thank you for taking the time to break that down, because it really summarizes a lot of what I've been feeling, I think, as well, from the context of especially navigating relationships with Black people who are in white evangelical spaces or predominantly white spaces. And in truth, we are all in predominantly white spaces in some way, shape, or form.
Yes, exactly.
if we're not necessarily in that physical space or in that church space, we're still under the white gaze. And so I've been honest about this from the standpoint of, I don't really know how much advice to give people anymore. And I think it connects with the way in which you're talking about anger. And you wrote something in Sojo.net that I really want to kind of unpack. And I think it's helpful for us to think through. And the title of your article is Black Rage in an Anti-Black World is a Spiritual Virtue.
Yeah.
And man, I've been really thinking about that. That's a powerful title and it's a powerful article to process the fury that I'm feeling. And one of the things that you say in the article, a quote that jumped out at me was, you said, and I quote here, rage shakes us out of our illusion that the world as it is what God wants. And I think the word illusion is particularly important in the context of our loyalty to things as they are, our loyalty to a nostalgic view of a person, of a relationship, of a people, of a church. Can you talk a little bit about the tyranny of loyalty to places that oppress us, to places that marginalize us? Because I think it's something for people, and we have so many people who are in predominantly white spaces who listen to the podcast, but so many Black Christians who are just trying to navigate life. And it seems as though we're trying to cling to this illusion. And this illusion is always refuted by the natural course of events. But how do you explain, or what do you think is important for us to understand about the illusion of the world as it is?
Yeah, that's real good. That's real good. So if I have to even think back to my own story, why did I believe the illusion? In that essay, I kind of, you know, in some sense, I'm very transparent in that essay and very vulnerable. Like there are stories that I actually included in that essay that didn't make it into it into the final copy of that particular essay, where I kind of tell the story where, you know, I was immersed in the white evangelical space. And, you know, I was the one who was selected, you know, to be, you know, the Black guy to lead the church through bloodlines, through Piper's bloodlines.
Because the church.
I was the chosen one, bro. I was Black Moses. I was the chosen one. I was Daniel in the lion's den. I was Nehemiah. I was the chosen one to lead us through John Piper's bloodline. And you know, in that particular space that I was in, you know, I go on to say, you know, I was probably the first one to be Black and to be preaching in that church that started in I think it was something crazy like 1881, if my memory serves me correctly. But then, you know, the illusion in some sense is rooted in this kind of, you know, I would in some sense call it a type of Black exceptionalism. A type of like, you know, hey, you know, it came with a badge of honor that, you know, you're breaking barriers in this space. Yo, I will never forget this. This literally was a catalytic moment in my life. So I came from California. So my wife, we got married right after college, graduated May 9th at Clemson, and then got married May 23rd. We living in California. I'm part of white spaces in California in the church, really immersed in the space. We get stationed back over here in Georgia where I live now. And I'm inside of this white evangelical church, immersed, preaching, teaching, leading, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I started to work at Enterprise Rent-A-Car. Now, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, wherever the rental place is situated, is kind of in these. You see the demographics based on where you at. I mean, I'm talking about where I was at. I had hookah smoke blown in my face. I mean, I had people want to fight me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was just crazy, whatnot. Great times, but just crazy times, right? And it was much different than another zip code. Or whatnot. And so, you know, as this is happening, you know, as this, you know, I'm in this white space and, you know, I'm back around Black people for real, for real. My social rhythms and location is now clashing with the social location that I chose. And so in some sense, that's the challenge where, you know, the social narrative that I'm thrown into is different from the social narrative that I've chosen for myself in the white evangelical space. And I'll never forget this, bro. I was in a conversation with one of my friends, Michaela, one of my best friends to this day. And Michaela, we was talking about like race and stuff like that. And I was like, what about black on black crime and this and that? And this is like in 20. Oh, I was that guy. I was that guy because I was like,
I was there too. I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, bro. I was black on black crime and I was doggone, you know, protesters need to, you know, are uncivilized. They need to do this and do that. Be more like King. And was like, you know, that's not the way of Jesus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Michaela said to me or whatnot, she said, Stu, she was pissed too. She was mad. She said, Stu, she said, you know, you, Stu, she was like, yo.
It's okay. You can stay pissed. It's fine.
Okay,
it's
good. Fine. Okay, good. Like, y'all should have seen this interaction just now. I was like, oh, man.
You good. I saw you look down. You're like,
Yeah,
you good. You can stay pissed.
All right. Yeah, yeah.
Black race. Come on,
dog. Yeah, okay, good. Perfect. Michaela was like, yo, Stu. She was like, you know, and I won't say this, but she said, you know, she said, Stu, you don't have a darn thing, insert other word, to offer black people. And you know, that happens, bro, you have a choice that you can make. When you are around black people again and you are in a white space and you see all of the things that are going on in our society, particularly to those who are looking like you, at some point, you're going to have to deal with that question, what does my faith have to say to our black reality? And you can either stay and choose to live in this illusion, or you can embrace that statement that Michaela told me and deal with it and make the courageous decision to say, I want to see better. And so,
That is... that is so helpful from the sense of what you have to offer someone.
Mm-hmm.
That's so helpful. And it's different because oftentimes what we have to offer people, it comes in conflict with, and it runs up against what others in power have to offer us.
Exactly.
And so we have to place real primacy on what is more important, what others have to offer us versus what I have to offer my people.
Exactly.
In thinking about that, you know, I was thinking when you were talking about this in the article, because I've been in this place myself, being in first black person to preach at church that used to have KKK members on the deacon board, or a church, you know, first black pastor to preach at a church that, you know, used to ban interracial marriage or whatever it may be, even though I'm in a black church setting. And so it, you know, I was curious, is there even a value in the presence of that anymore? Like, is there even a value in being the first to break a barrier? Like, what is that even? What value is that? Because you said something before we got on that I thought was extremely extremely moving. You said, I don't want our best work to go somewhere. I want our best work to be for us, not for something else. And I want to give you the opportunity to say that.
Okay.
You know, because I think it's, we are so infatuated with being the first, and we're so infatuated with being the person to be relied upon. And I think it comes from this perverse sense of self-importance and exceptionalism that you mentioned. And so is there even a value to that? You know, that's just something I was thinking about. Is there a value to being a first black, whatever it may be, first black person to be in this space, first black person to, you know, run this Christian organization? What is the value of that today?
I think, you know, on a historical level, I think there is value to that, because on the historical level, your name will forever be recorded in the annals of history. And so in some sense, you know, when one reads your name or whatnot, you know, they will forever remember you as, you know, breaking that barrier. So when Brown versus Board of Education happened, you know, we saw, if you haven't, if listeners, if you haven't, you know, checked out Eyes on the Prize or whatnot.
Essential.
Essential documentary. Long. Or whatnot. This is probably going to take you about a year to get through now. It's long winded, but it's good. It's not hot dog, burnt hot dogs on paper plates. It's actually filet mignon on fine china. So, you know, it's a really good thing. And we remember from Eyes on the Prize all, you know, the courage of Black people in this world, you know, who indeed were first to break barriers in particular places, you know, being the first to, you know, integrate a school, being a first to become a mayor, being a first to whatever, go to a university or get a degree. And so one of the things I think about being a first, I think the value is, yes, it's a historical value to it. But the question that I face today, looking back on it, and I think Black people will deal, we're in some sense dealing with this question all the time, is when I am a first, what has it cost me personally, and what does it cost us collectively?
That's it. Yeah. That's it.
And so, you know, in some sense, there's a beautiful Toni Morrison quote in an essay that she wrote entitled The Site of Memory. I think it was an essay for the Tanner Lectures on the Humanities, which is a really good lecture series that's going on, that's been going on for some time now. And in the essay, you know, The Site of Memory, Toni Morrison kind of, you know, navigates memory as, you know, a powerful force in shaping the future. So she would say that memory allows us to ponder the actual, but it also allows us to imagine the possible. So memory allows us to ponder the actual, but imagine the possible. So if I was to flip Toni Morrison's quote, when we're the first, it allows us to imagine what's possible at the expense of pondering what's actual. And so when W.E. Du Bois, when Du Bois goes and he gets this PhD from Harvard University, we can imagine the possible. When, you know, somebody has broken barriers in the business, in the political, in the church, in the sports world, we can imagine the possible. But oftentimes, usually it is the case when we look in history that those who have been the first, we have lost the ability to ponder the actual. And so when I think about my own story, oftentimes when you're the first, you have too much to lose, to be honest, about the situation that you entered in.
That's so good. Yeah.
So you have too much to lose. So, you know, I can't be Black and angry lest I lose my job. I can't be Black and tired, kind of like Nehemiah, when Nehemiah and we should get into this or whatnot about, you know, ways that the evangelical space has taught us how to read biblical narratives that in some sense continue to not only to suppress us, but also to oppress us and to keep us silent. So we should definitely get into this. But when we look at Nehemiah's story, Nehemiah, he's a cupbearer. So he's struggling with, you know, having to show emotion and what his emotions would mean for him or whatnot. We don't know. Maybe Nehemiah was a first, but we need to ask the question, how did he get there? Babylon, they killed their people. they took their resources. They raped their women, children, or whatnot. And they were very violent. And he might have been a first, but how did he get there? And what does that cost the larger community? And Nehemiah, that is a, in some sense, relevant narrative in my sanctified preacher imagination. Able to, you know, navigate, you know, what does it mean to be Black in these spaces while also trying to navigate with what it means to be the first and what is that costing, not simply me, but costing our community. And when that time comes, when you get word about what's happening in your community, when you get word, you see that cop's foot, knee on his neck in very public ways. You see Ahmaud Arbery happen. You see Ferguson happen. You see the white rage in Trump, and you see the silence and complicity of those who have been charged love you in the way, you know, that they're for me. And it's even weird for me saying that, thinking about being Black in the white space. It's hard. Yeah. I'm telling you, man, it's hard, you know, for people who have long been trained how to see you as less than to actually love you more than you can imagine. And so we can deal with that on another day. But I think Nehemiah has relevance of, you know, what is, you know, yes, it's relevant to have to be the first, but I need to ask, how did I get there, and what is it costing me and us as a collective community?
Man, that's so helpful. And I'm glad you talked about memory too. You know, you mentioned this in your Ahmaud Arbery essay on CT. You talked about how memory calls us forward, like to a better future, and how mm-hmm. memory connects with our future. Mm-hmm. Playing off that Toni Morrison concept. And, you know, there was something as we think about memory and as we think about being first and being exceptional, and mm-hmm. as we think about just how we respond to things, in your Black Rage essay, you mentioned something about rage becoming the public expression of a theological truth, you know, and that theological truth is that Black lives matter to God. Mm-hmm. And so most of us breeze past that. But I think there's something implicit in what you're saying that's a corrective to the larger Christian community, which is that emotion can be truth.
Yes, exactly.
Emotional expression can be truth. And most of us don't see that. And it's interesting, I think, because for many of us, we process our emotions of fear. Mm-hmm. And we don't question them, like especially in white settings, they process fear easily, but they don't question their fear. They don't question their apprehension. They don't question their consideration of what could possibly happen if this, if not, if I don't have a weapon, if I go into this neighborhood, et cetera.
Yes.
And that is treated through truthful actions. But what you're connecting emotion to is theological truth. So what I want to ask you is, how can emotion be truth? Explain that to people. How is emotion truth? Because many of us are afraid to express rage because we think it is outside of the theological bounds.
Yes.
Yet I think there is actually a theological underpinning to it.
Exactly.
As you're mentioning it. So how can emotion be truth, Dante?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And, you know, in some sense, that's the reason why I wrote this piece, is because, you know, in this moment, you know, we, as Black people, as we're trying to navigate this moment, you know, it's very easy to see ourselves through a Du Boisian double consciousness. Now, let me kind of let me work that out real quick or whatnot. So W.E.B. Du Bois, I talk with a list, so I got to really that's a tongue twister. Tongue twister. Du Bois would say, you know, in The Souls of Black Folk, he says oftentimes, you know, we have to see ourselves as Black, but in some sense through the white gaze, that, you know, we're Black in this country, but oftentimes we're trying to be Black in a country that does not love us back. We love this country, but this country does not love us. And so in some sense, it's like the 1619 Project, when Nicole Hannah-Jones opened an essay, you know, about Black people and democracy, that we have been the perfecters of democracy in America, that, you know, she opened up that essay talking about her father and her father, you know, having the American flag or whatnot. She was wondering, like, why or whatnot. And so in some sense, Du Bois would say, you know, there's always this kind of disparity or this kind of war within themselves between being Black and being American, being Black and seeing ourselves through the white gaze. And so, you know, if we kind of read that through a psychological lens, we could say that the Du Bois and self-consciousness becomes the Black coping mechanism of what it means to live in the anti-Black world. It becomes a coping mechanism to see oneself as Black through the white gaze or whatnot. It, in some sense, is to realize that I'm Black and I need to survive. Now, for me, that's a defensive kind of coping mechanism that Du Bois is setting for us. He's kind of telling the story. For me, I wanted to go on the offensive to give theological language of this double consciousness. I wanted to be someone who says we're Black and we're going to go on the offensive and correct the white gaze and give us a new gaze and new theological language, which is in some sense old theological language. It is, you know, if in some sense we read the text, yeah, if we read the text not from the lens of how white and European Christians have in some sense forced us to read in history or whatnot. One simply has to look at the slave Bible to see this. One simply, you know, has to look at Frederick Douglass, you know, quote that, you know, I love the Christianity of Christ, but I really don't like, you know, the Christianity of this land. And so the Christianity of Christ and the Christianity of land is not a process that is neutral. No, both of these are actually actively warring for one's imagination. They're actually at odds with one another, trying to navigate how one reads the Bible, how one reads one story, how one reads one society, and what it can be and can become. And so for me, when I look at the Bible, let me go back to Nehemiah. When I think about, you know, Black rage as a, in some sense, the public expression of a theological truth, that Black rage becomes a public expression. The reason I wrote that section, this section grew out of my devotional reading of Nehemiah's story. Can I preach for a little bit?
Can I? I got an organ on me, but you know.
Okay, it's all good. Can I go to the text? Take me to the text. So in Nehemiah's story, I already set the context of Nehemiah's story earlier. You know, in Nehemiah's story, Nehemiah is existing in Babylon, which is a existence that sees him not simply as second class, but it exploits his dignity and it constantly forces on him the disrespect of what it means to exist in this reality. So Nehemiah is constantly being re-traumatized, constantly being reminded of his second class citizenship, constantly being reminded that he has to suppress his emotions about the history and the memory that lives deep down within his bones. So Nehemiah gets story about his people. He gets story that, you know, the walls have been broken down. And when we go to the walls in the Hebrew Bible, it's not simply, you know, this kind of spiritual truth of protection, but it's this kind of existential reality of the walls is anything in our community that allows us to have political, social, economic, and cultural life that we can say that we are a people and we are building meaning and a meaningful world together. And so Nehemiah gets this word that, you know, hey, the walls have been torn down. And Nehemiah, you know, responds that in the way that many of us have responded. Nehemiah is sad at this reality. He is sad that things are happening to his people and to his community. And so Nehemiah prays. He says, Lord, give me favor with you. Give me favor with man so that we can go back and rebuild the walls. And so Nehemiah, he goes about this work. And Nehemiah, you know, goes and travels back to Jerusalem. But the role, it goes back to the people, but the role is always met with opposition. And the type of opposition that Nehemiah met is an opposition that doesn't just want to distract him. It wants to destroy him. And so they lie on Nehemiah, you know, trying to upset the work. And so Nehemiah has to make the courageous decision, not simply to pray to God, but to also become the action to which his prayers would be answered. And so when we go to the text, we have to realize, yeah, that as Howard Thurman would say, it doesn't make much sense to pray for something that you don't want to partner with God to become the answer. And so Nehemiah would understand that he was not simply his ancestors' wildest dreams when he got up out of Babylon and went back to his people, but Nehemiah also became his ancestors' unanswered prayers. And so his reality of going back there was the very outworking of partnering with God to answer the prayers. And so Nehemiah goes to his people and he realized, I think this is in chapter 5. I love how some of the translation committees have kind of translated this text and kind of outlined this text for us. It's some of them simply say Nehemiah responds to injustice. And so, you know, we haven't oftentimes heard texts preached this way, that there is actually a way to respond to injustice. So Nehemiah, he goes back to the community and he gives us a framework of how our rage becomes an expression of a theological truth. And so Nehemiah, he sees injustice, he gets angry at injustice, he thinks about it, and then Nehemiah brings charges against those whom are committing and sustaining injustice. And so Nehemiah, his rage, his anger, the Bible said he thought it over and he was angry about it. And you know, our anger, it is our anger, our deep-seated pain, our anger and our rage that gets us out of this illusion that this gross system of inequality, expectation, and disrespect is the will of God for any people's life. Wow. And so as Christians in particular, you know, and people, all people of goodwill and good faith, we have to say that rage, as I write, becomes the work of love that stands against an unloving world. And so Nehemiah responds to injustice with anger to say, I can't simply think about it, but I need to get angry about it and I need to do something about it. I need to mobilize against it. And so I love this part of the narrative around verse 10 to 13, where the Bible says he brings charges and they respond to his charges with this way. Man, this thing about shout me and bless me, brother. They respond to Nehemiah's anger and charges. He says, y'all need to commit to reparations for the damage that has been done against our people. Y'all, I don't know how y'all gonna do it or whatnot, and I can give you some suggestions, but y'all need to repair the damage that has been done emotionally, psychologically, culturally, politically, and economically. You need to restore what has been lost in the people. Their dignity has not simply been lost, but their destiny has also been lost. And we need to restore both of those. And so then this thing blessed me, man. They responded that we're going to do whatever you said. And this is what the Bible said. It says that all of the people said, amen.
Amen. That's what they said. Yeah.
Mighty God.
Man, that's powerful. And it's so amazing that you break that down because, you know, again, most of us do not read the text that way.
Exactly.
And we do not read from that lens and we don't read from, you know, as you, I think so aptly said earlier, that social location, right?
Yes.
Man, that's so helpful. And, you know, as we think about that, I think it's important to kind of talk through some of the particular ways as well that not even just in particular text, but overarching, like our theology and our faith expression has been manipulated and turned against us. You know, so, you know, isn't it the great manipulation that something that can be liberative turns into a force of oppression? You know, something that should be loving turns into a conduit for hate.
Yes, and, exactly.
You know, one of the chief objections many people have to the faith and how many people, Black people, are trying to reconcile that. So as you're seeing this, what are some ways that our faith is being manipulated and turned against us, you know, in an intellectual sense, in an overarching sense, from the 30,000 foot view? You know, what are some of the lies that are being told to us that we should reject and we should angrily, furiously push back on?
Yeah, exactly. It's back to that framework. And I can't take, you know, I can't take credit for this framework. It's a framework that Charles W. Mills, would use in the racial contract, in the book, The Racial Contract, I think, where he would say, you know, in some sense that, you know, if we're talking about racial justice, then we need to dismantle second class citizenship, racist exploitation, and racist disrespect. And so if we're thinking about ways, you know, that we have, that our faith has been manipulated, it the way that we have been trained, particularly in our seminaries and in our churches or whatnot, it and particularly in the white spaces that many of us either have come from, gone into, or existing in right now, this space has shown that, you know, Black people are second class citizens when it comes to reading theology, when it comes to doing theology, and that their second class citizenship must find its legitimacy in what white Christians think about Black theology. And I want to say this like very clearly. At the end of the day, Black people have not had any freedom worrying about white thoughts on what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
We have not been Black and Christian. And in some sense, the test of our legitimacy falls on white people, because every time throughout history, and I'm not just saying this, I'm going to quote some white brothers and sisters, particularly Ronald Niebuhr. It has been in history that, you know, when Black people want to create their reality, want to become agents in their destiny, white brothers and sisters have been more concerned about charity versus liberating justice. And so let me work that out a little bit real quick.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So charity, in some sense, you know, is glad to have us in the number, is glad to have us, you know, inside the space and to market us, you know, to the masses, to, in some sense, to show that they're being not racist or whatever, that, you know, we finally, when they get like one or two or three Black people, they can finally say we're becoming a multi ethnic, mind you, they, a lot of them don't even say multiracial. And I think we need to change that language, because America doesn't have an ethnicity problem. America has a racist problem. And so we can get ethnicities together, but we need to deal with the racial terror and nightmare that we all are living in. And so this kind of theologizing in our seminaries and in our histories and how we tell the story of theology in America, in some sense, relegates Black people to a great idea, but not a great transformative force as it relates to what it means to have good news in this godforsaken land. And so Black people, in some sense, are seen as second class citizens, and our legitimacy must be tested against, you know, the white logic, the kind of white narrative. So what does these reformed people think about our theology? What does, you know, these seminaries think about our theology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or whatnot? We can't get too far out of that mark, or, you know, they're going to think something about us that we're, you know, being troublemakers, we're upsetting things, or whatnot. And so not only are we second class when it comes to theology, but also we are exploited. And so the best of our Black thinkings are to build a kind of white Christian America. You know, the best of our Black thinking becomes, you know, inside of this white space. And like you were saying earlier, we have to ask ourselves the question, is the best of our work and the best of our intellect and the best of our years going to be for white people? Or is the best of our years and intellect going to be for building a Black reality that loves ourselves deeply, that loves God, that loves our neighbor, that loves our world? Because at the end of the day, we have to refuse to in some sense, give these institutions and organizations who are already well off, who are not burdened with the tragedy of blackness in America, who are making money off our black bodies and not trying to shape our black minds for a black reality, who are in some sense, you know, making us super marketable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have to say at the end of the day, we are losing way too much to stay in this place that they want us. Because at the end of the day, bruh, Babylon didn't come up with the idea to send Nehemiah back. Mm-hmm. Can we be honest?
Come on. Yeah, come on.
Can
man.
We come be on. Honest? Babylon never had a liberating agenda for Nehemiah. Babylon didn't care that whether Nehemiah, you know, what Nehemiah did in his private life or whatnot, what he did when, you know, everybody who came from his community who was still there, you know, was still under the brand of Babylonian kind of logic, but still kind of gathering in their own little spaces and being mad privately. They didn't care, you know, whether they made these conferences for black people while still being tied to the white space. They didn't care whether that happened because at the end of the day, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that doesn't change anything. That doesn't deal with a given system of injustice that we are living in that has kind of robbed us of dignity, robbed us of our agency in shaping this world. And so Babylon never came up with that agenda. It was Nehemiah who came up with that agenda, who prayed to God. And guess what? At the end of the day, Nehemiah's courage did not come from his conversation with King Artaxerxes. It came from his courage in his conversation with God. Artaxerxes was only the conduit of this kind of agenda for him. But it was God who gave him the energy, who gave him the force to go and try and rebuild what has been lost. And I think, you know, when we're talking about Christian faith in America, too oftentimes black people are so well, I'm a name drop real quick, and forgive me if I step on some toes real quick or whatnot. Too often, too many black people in America, in a post-Katrina America, which we're kind of coming of age in, we young black people coming of age in a post-Katrina America, in a post-Barack Obama America, in a post-Trump, in a post-Black Lives Matter, in a post-Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and all these countless hashtags, you know, when we think about this reality that's happening or whatnot, This space is not going to, in some sense, help us learn the language and the theology of a James Cone. It's going to make sure that we learn the theology of a John Calvin. And
come on, bro. And JC too many, or JC, that's a question.
Yeah. Too many young black people know how to expound the historical narrative of John Calvin, but they don't know how to navigate the existential terror of James Cone.
Come on, bro.
Nehemiah, in some sense, and Daniel and them in the lion's den. Hey, bro, we understand them or whatnot. It's cool. But the reality is that, you know, theology arises out of a community's response to a living God who has actions in history. And so as we navigate this theological story, we have to ask ourselves, what is good news for black people in America in 2020 when we are lynched, when we have policies and practices that are against us? What is the good news? Like, I text a pastor. Pastor texted me this morning. I won't drop that name. That's my dude. I love him to death. He texted me this morning. He was talking about everything that was going on. And I said, you know, hey, I'm like, what is good news that you have to offer for black people in this moment? You know, too often, you know, we have relegated James Cone to this kind of language of heretic because James Cone had the courage to talk about white supremacy. And so, you know, James Cone had the courage to talk about the cross as being connected to the lynching tree. James Cone had the courage to navigate the story of when Jesus addressed Legion. He didn't want to read it simply as the spiritual power of Jesus. Jesus to liberate one from demonic oppression. He want to navigate that, you know, Jesus liberates a community from this kind of demonic structure that sees them as less than. So when Jesus addresses Legion and he casts Legion into the swine, Jewish people don't eat swine. Only Romans who wanted to come through their land to have meat whenever they needed wanted the swine for the people. So when Jesus cast out the demon into the swine and the swine cast itself into the went off the cliff, Jesus was not simply saying, I want to liberate this brother from the psychological dimensions and the existential dimensions of what it means to be demonically oppressed. But I want to liberate this community from being bound to the tragic dimensions of being second-class citizens who are exploited and constantly disrespected. And Black people need to take a hiatus from reading white theology for a little minute. It's all right. We love white brothers and sisters. We love them deeply. I love, I'm okay, here we go. I got that white friend. I got white friend. I love my white brothers deeply and my white sisters deeply, but how can someone who asks me, hey, I need you to teach me about race, lead me to think about race? It's impossible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's such a good word for us as far as our framing and the way in which we perceive and interact with theology and the ways in which our faith is slowly teaching us to hate ourselves.
Yes.
Or as Malcolm X would say, giving us that mask of self-hate and self-doubt. You know, one last thing I think is that's so important, I think this is going to help so many people, is this concept of education. And often we talk about education in a racial sense. You know, what do we channel our rage into? And people talk about action as far as education. And typically it's education for other people. And it's education for, you know, a white majority. But I think what's so fascinating about this is, you know, Carter G. Woodson said once that, you know, every Black person has two educators, basically, you know, education that is given to us, but then the education that we give ourselves.
Exactly.
And it was so important, you know, kind of spinning off what you're talking about, even with the regurgitation of white theology and things like that. I was thinking about the education we give ourselves, and I was thinking about it in the context of Black women. And I think it's so important to name Black women. You know, we talk about George Floyd and we talk about Ahmaud Arbery, but, you know, we don't talk enough about Breonna Taylor and Tatiana Jefferson, and Rakia Boyd and Renisha McBride and Sandra Bland and so many others that are nameless and faceless to us. There's that sense of erasure. And it's so important to receive an education that values all of our people and that values all of our experiences. And so thinking about that education, how do we educate ourselves, man? How do we educate ourselves in the midst of anger? Because I think anger is necessary. You know, there's one writer who called it naked anger. I love that, that analogy and that phrase, because I think it serves such a purpose and a utility. I think of Jesus going in the temple and flipping the tables and whipping them boys. He was whipping them boys.
Bro. You know, and I
know people are like, he wasn't hitting them. I'm like, he was whipping
them. Yeah.
And so as you think about that, Jesus in the midst of anger is actually educating people.
Yes.
So he's educating his own people by saying, this is my Father's house. And so the connection to my Father's house is I want you to understand the Godhead and the nature of which you're supposed to treat God's property, right?
Exactly.
And what you're supposed to bring into God's property. And so as we consider that, man, how do we educate ourselves in a time of anger, and how do we educate ourselves in a way that's going to promote us to action? I think that's just such an important thing for Black Christians to hear in this time.
That's good. I think education, you know, happens on the personal and the public and the kind of pulpit dimension. So I see, you know, as a minister, you know, I think there is a integral and integrated relationship between the public, the pulpit, and the pew. And so as we think about all three of those integrations, I mean, all the three of those kind of relationships and roles, I think in some sense there must be, you know, a integration of them in very systematic and strategic ways. And so if we think about the pulpit, you know, preaching Nehemiah, not simply as a good story of God's action in Nehemiah's life, but to read it as Rowan Williams would say in his book, Being Christian. Rowan, I think it was Being Christian when he had that section on the Bible, to realize that this is not a story about God's action in Nehemiah's life. We should read Nehemiah as a story of God's action in our lives as well. And so when we read stories of them, we can see ourselves in their stories, and we can say, this is how somebody responded well, this is how somebody responded not so well to God, and how do we understand our stories in light of God's stories, in hope that we can tell a better story together today. And so the pulpit has to be the place on a ministerial level or an ecclesial level to be able to educate us or whatnot. And for me, I like to use language of imagination. We have to reimagine or whatnot, because in some sense, for me, re-educate is very static. Reimagine, in some sense, is a process. Yeah, where it's more like a dance rather than, you know, kind of living in a classroom. Imagination allows one to see that, you know, in some sense, God just doesn't want to teach me inside of a book. God wants to teach me on the streets. And so, like I say, that when we talk about, you know, Black Rage becomes this kind of reimagination work, that it allows me to see that this world as it is not the way that God wants it, and that this world as it is not, you know, the way that it should be, and that it allows us to realize that in some sense, like, you know, we need to try and reimagine life together, building a common life together. You know, we're not trying to create a Christian nation. What we're trying to do is be Christians, be Black, and try and create a more loving and just world together. And so that education work must be beyond the pulpit. Work goes beyond simply, you know, the needs of the pulpit. That work goes to the lives of those in the pew. And those who have lives in the pew, all of us coming from the life of the public. And so the way that we navigate conversations that's happening in the pew and this kind of like imagination work together, we must not forget that we must build life together in the public, and that the public has something to teach us about how we imagine ourselves inside of the church space. What should be priorities inside of the church space? And if this seems like dangerous language, you know, we need to look at, in some sense, the story of the Good Samaritan. We have to realize that the Levite and the priest, you know, got just close enough to the one who's on the ground for them to be listed in the story. But the one who remember is the one who stopped. And you know, we have to navigate that we have to realize, like, you know, we need this integral relationship between the pulpit, the pew, and the public. Now, that's kind of on a 30,000 foot view. You know, in my personal life, we as Christians, we have to take seriously this language of the image of God in other people. If I believe that people are created in the image of God, then that must mean that they have something of legitimate value to offer me, not simply me to offer them. And so as Christians, if we're being honest, as Christians, too often we have related to our neighbors as sinners first, and then image bearers second.
Oh, yes, we have. Yes, sir.
And that changes how you relate to another person. When you relate to someone as first sinner, then image of a person as an image bearer, this, in some sense, is always going to have a narrative of difference. You're going to always be kind of, you know, limited in your ways of being human and trying to learn and build a life together. And so Christians, we need to read beyond simply theology. We need to read beyond these things. We need to read, you know, I read everybody. I mean, I'm talking about,
you have to.
You know, yeah, I read everybody, because in some sense, I realize that as a person, I am situated within the world. My social narrative is this: I am Black, I am a Christian and I am trying to learn how to navigate both of those realities in a world with other people. And so if we're talking about even in Christian faith, not simply, you know, Imago Dei, if we're talking about Christians, it doesn't make much sense for me to preach and to praise a reality in eternity where these voices around the throne are bearing witness to God's action in eternity. If they are bearing witness in eternity, then it must mean that they have bear witness in the present. And if they have bear witness in the present, then I need to be learning from them in the present, because if I'm not learning from them and living with them and trying to build their life for them in the present, I sure ain't going to catch the Holy Ghost and love them when we are in glory. It just ain't going to happen like that. It ain't going to happen. And so we need to learn how to read other people. There is nothing, you know, spiritual about lacking a type of intelligence that's willing to read other people. There is nothing spiritual about that. Like the spiritual reality is that I'm willing to be a Christian in this world while navigating life with other people, reading them and loving them with, not simply if I'm to love my neighbor as myself, or love my, you know, the second commandment is like it. You know, we should love our God with our mind, with our heart, with our spirit, and with all our strength. And the second command is like it. So I should love my neighbor with my mind, with my heart, with my spirit, and with my strength. And that becomes an integral reality of loving God as well. And so I read everybody. I think Christians need to be reading everybody and trying to, you know, read from diverse groups, whether they, you know, are in your community or not, whether they agree with you or not, or whatnot. Because the reality is that we Christians have sucked at, you know, building a life together. And that's because we don't have models of that. You know, I tell white people all the time, you know, the reason why white brothers and sisters are struggling in this moment is because most of their models have been violent white supremacists. We need a white liberation theology right now. We need white liberation theology. You need to be liberated from whiteness. You need to be liberated from white supremacy. You need to be liberated from what Eddie Glaude would call the value gap that values white lives and white communities more than other lives and other communities, white pain and white rage and white anger more than other communities. And so, you know, white brothers and sisters, they don't have models of liberation and love. So therefore, they're struggling in this moment to figure out how to answer the questions. And so therefore, they need white brothers and sisters, and we all need better models of that, who will model, particularly for us as Christians, who will model being both, you know, for me, Black and Christian, and seeing those as integrals. Because the reality is this, I don't care how many, I wrote this in one of the essays that I wrote for y'all, to the letter to the young Black Christian. I don't care how many books you read, no matter how many Bible verses you quote, no matter how upstanding or morally upright you are, I can be best friends with Craig Groeschel. I can be best friends with John Piper. I can be best friends with anybody. I don't care. I can be in their circle. But the reality is that when I step out into this world, they see me first as Black. And that means something. And we need to answer that. And I think, you know, our personal education and my education, you know, as a person, you know, this is why I read so ferociously, is because I'm trying to live. And, you know, I love, like I wrote in that essay on the motto, we love Jesus, but we're also trying to live. And I refuse to live my best life loving white people more than I love my Black son.
Wow. Whew. That's a word, brother. Man, Dante Stewart, Young Baldwin. Thank you so much, brother.
Man, thank you so much for coming on, man.
You ended your post on Black Rage by saying, until we are all free, we can never rest.
Oh, right? Yes.
And I think that's just, you set us on fire for never resting and for doing what we can and channeling our anger. Man, I wanted to give you the opportunity before we let you go to just talk a little bit about your podcast, man, which is coming up, and I definitely want people to check it out and see what's going on. So I talked a little bit about it in the intro. So, man, tell us about the podcast.
Yeah, man. I first, thank you. That's pretty dope. You know, man, I love podcasts. I just love conversations with people. I think, you know, the podcast, you know, has caught the traction that it has, you know, because it is not like an interview. You get to kind of, because in an interview, you know, you go on TV, you have to be mindful of what you say. You got to, you know, you got a certain time to say certain things or whatnot. And so for me, I felt like, you know, the podcast was a space where we can simply, you know, be free and not feel like, you know, we kind of have to be bound to this kind of, you know, professionalism, though, this kind of professionalism that is not authentic or whatnot. And so for me and my friend Modi, we love Code Switch. We love Own Being. We love, you know, that social media humans of New York.
Yeah.
And I love, you know, just like various podcasts like this podcast, Pastor Mike, and, you know, other podcasts like my friend Annie Downs, who has a great podcast. Who else am I listening to? I listen to Career Rochelle podcast and Albert Tate.
Leadership Pod.
Huh? Yeah, that Leadership Pod and Albert Tate over in Cali and Derwin Gray or whatnot. And I like all the things that they're doing, you know, and we wanted to kind of merge all these type of worlds. Just imagine like stories between, just imagine the humans of New York, imagine Own Being podcast with the theological and religious reflection, Code Switch with, you know, the reflection on race and politics. And, you know, we wanted to create something where we can tell stories. And so the podcast is entitled The Stories Between Us, where I say, you know, stories matter, not just, you know, any story, but our stories, that they connect us to ourselves, to one another, and to the rest of the world. You know, that these stories don't just connect us, but that it is these narratives that possess power to create a more loving and just world. And so, you know, at the story, my podcast is going to be titled The Stories Between Us. And at The Stories Between Us, you know, we're a place where ordinary stories intersect in extraordinary ways. And as we tell these stories, you know, with candor and courage, with imagination and joy, we create better stories together. And maybe one day a better story can be told. So we're going to be dropping soon or whatnot, where we're going to be a place where ordinary stories intersect in extraordinary ways. And we got some dope conversations that we got coming up. So check us out. We're going to be dropping soon, real soon.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for being on, bro. I'm excited to listen to these stories and you tell these stories and to continue following you and all your work. So I just say from black man to black man, I appreciate you, brother. Continue on. Until each one of us is free, we're not going to stop. So I appreciate you, Dante. Thank you so much for joining us on Pastor Mike.
Yeah, for sure, bro. Much love to you. Much love to Pastor Mike. Much love to The Witness. Much love to everybody. Lot of everybody. Y'all take care. Y'all be blessed, man.